Thank you so very much for being in our worship assembly tonight. On Sunday evenings, we have chosen to take a book of the Bible and give an overview, followed the next Sunday night by a text, a lesson using some particular text of that book. Tonight, we'd like to give an overview of 2 Kings in the Old Testament. Thank you for opening your Bible and looking at some of the passages that will be mentioned in our overview. It's impossible to mention every detail of the book. Thank you for following along and the notes that you're making, both on paper and mentally, that will help you in your spiritual growth as a Christian. The title of the book, 2 Kings, as you remember, we mentioned the books of 1 and 2 Kings were originally one book named from the first word in 1 Kings in the Hebrew text, which is translated now King. The background of the book, it's really a continuation of 1 Kings, as you would imagine that it would be, taking up where the former book left off in the middle of the brief reign of Ahaziah, son of Ahab. A parallel passage to this particular book is in 2 Chronicles 20, chapter 21 through chapter 36. And as the book opens, the kingdom is still divided. You remember at the end of 1 Kings, God's kingdom divided into a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. The northern kingdom being the kingdom of Israel, the southern kingdom being the kingdom of Judah. In the northern kingdom of Israel, it continued to deteriorate until it was utterly destroyed by Assyria in the year 722 B.C. The northern kingdom had a total of 19 kings, and every one of them were evil. From Jeroboam to Hoshea, the seven dynasties or seven families. After the Assyrians destroyed the northern kingdom, they marched into the southern kingdom of Judah. Through efforts of King Hezekiah and the prophet Isaiah, God spared the southern kingdom, and it lasted for another 150 years. Finally, however, the southern kingdom also fell as it was conquered by the Babylonians in 586 B.C. Judah also had a total of 19 kings, but they were not all bad like the kings of the north. Rehoboam to Zedekiah, all descendants of David, by the way. Judah had four good kings, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Hezekiah, and Josiah. But most of these kings worshipped both God and idols. Looking at it from a historical perspective, the book has two main divisions. Chapters 1 through 17 comprise that first major division of the book. In Israel, from Ahaziah to Hoshea, a period of 176 years, 897 to 721 B.C., largely the record of Elijah's last days and ascension in chapter 1 and chapter 2, and then the ministry of Elisha, who succeeded him as prophet of God in chapter 2 through chapter 13. And then the second major division of the book, chapter 18 through the end of the book, which is chapter 25, in Judah from Hezekiah to Zedekiah, a period of 155 years. Basically, history books, 1 and 2 Kings, are written from the standpoint of the prophets who had a job before God to call people back to God. Most of the political accomplishments of the kings that happened during this historical period of time are largely ignored in the book. That's not the purpose of God's writing that he's having done here. It's irrelevant to God's plans and purposes. The leading prophets were Elijah, Elisha, Isaiah, and Jeremiah. First and Second Kings together cover a time period of about 430 years from the death of David to the fall of the southern kingdom, Judah. Second Kings gives the history of Israel from the death of the wicked king Ahab to the destruction of Israel in 721 BC, and the history of Judah from the good king Hezekiah to the fall of Judah to Babylon in 586 BC. The division that happened between these two kingdoms happened in the year 975 BC. The period covered by the two books of Kings begins with King David and ends with the capture of the southern kingdom with the king of Babylon. It opens with the temple being built, and it closes with the temple being destroyed. It begins with David's successor on the throne of his kingdom, and it ends with David's last successor, Jehoiachin, released from the house of captivity. The first half of 2 Kings, chapters 1 through 13, is largely a record of Elisha's ministry of 66 years following Elijah's last days and ascension, as we mentioned. The second half of the book is an account of events leading up to the fall of Samaria, the capture of Israel in chapters 14 through 17, and then Judah alone for some 135 years, the decline of the nation, the fall of Jerusalem, the captivity that is spent in Babylon, chapters 18 through 25. You have probably in your study Bible an outline of the book that would look something similar to this, maybe not exactly. We've talked about outlines before and their purpose for us. You can get pretty detailed in outlines, or you can get an outline that's pretty much basic. But they're probably going to contain something similar to the outline that's on the overhead for you to see. This book, 2 Kings, has 25 chapters in it, 719 verses, approximately 23,532 words, if you're thinking about reading that tonight before you go to bed. You see, there are two divisions, major divisions, as we mentioned, in the book. The first one here is described as the divided kingdom continues, and you can see some of the information included in there with the reign of these different kings. The reign of these kings showing us a time period or chronology that really doesn't deal with historical detail, as we mentioned, not a political evaluation of each king, that sort of thing, like it would be written from a secular historian's perspective. This is God's history. This is for the purpose of God. And so there naturally would be more focus on the spiritual aspect of it. There would naturally be more focus on those who were selected to speak for God as his prophets. And then in the second part of the outline, you see the second major division there, the kingdom of Judah alone, that talks about the reigns of the kings in Judah. That's the type of information that you would see in an outline about the book of 2 Kings. If we want to think about key words in the book, we might think of the word downfall or captivity, because that's what happens in this book, and it's not very pleasant to think about the downfall or the captivity of God's people. But of course, you know, valuable lessons to be learned from that. Key verses. What might be some key verses in the book that you might hear and immediately recognize? You might hear and call to remembrance something you studied before, a valuable lesson, something that you appreciated from the Old Testament about God or about God's people that could help you in your walk as a Christian today. What might some of those verses be? Well, chapter 12, verse 2 and 3 might be one of those that you would recognize. Jehoash did right in the sight of the Lord all his days in which Jehoiada the priest instructed him. Only the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. And you remember these high places were places reserved for idolatry. And what had God said about idolatry? Was he pleased with idolatry? Was that an acceptable alternative religion for the people of God to engage in? Certainly not. And so when you see the actions of the people and giving their hearts over to idolatry, it's a sad day when reading about God's people to read such a thing. Chapter 17, 22 and 23, the sons of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel from his sight, as he spoke through all his servants, the prophets. So Israel was carried away into exile from their own land to Assyria until this day. You know, that's a bad event for the people of God. It's just heartbreaking to read such a thing that happened to the people of God in chapter 17. Then in chapter 21, 13 through 15, I will stretch over Jerusalem the line of Samaria and the plummet of the house of Ahab. And I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. I will abandon the remnant of my inheritance and deliver them into the hand of their enemies, and they will become as plunder and spoil to all their enemies. Because they have done evil in my sight and have been provoking me to anger since the day their fathers came from Egypt, even unto this day. You know, another sad section of Scripture in the Word of God showing how God's people can fall away from loving Him and serving Him. Interesting expression in that passage, I think, when God says, I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish. Now, that's just a horrible thing to think about. In the reality of what happened historically to that city, how bad it was. Chapter 23, verses 25 through 27, are another interesting passage in the book. Before him there was no king like him who turned to the Lord with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his might according to the law of Moses. Nor did any like him arise after him. However, the Lord did not turn from the fierceness of his great wrath with which his anger burned against Judah because of all the provocations with which Manasseh had provoked him. The Lord said, I will remove Judah also from my sight as I have removed Israel. And I will cast off Jerusalem, this city which I have chosen, and the temple of which I said, my name shall be there. Chapter 24, the first four verses of that chapter might be something that would be key in the book. In his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years. Then he turned and rebelled against him. The Lord sent against him bands of Chaldeans, bands of Arameans, bands of Moabites, and bands of Ammonites. So he sent them against Judah to destroy it according to the word of the Lord, which he had spoken through his servants, the prophets. Surely at the command of the Lord it came upon Judah to remove them from his sight because of the sins of Manasseh according to all that he had done, and also for the innocent blood which he shed, for he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord would not forgive. You know, in that passage, you can see how spiritually low people can become and what sort of sins they can commit against the God of heaven that provokes him to a fierce anger. Well, those aren't lovely and grace-provoking passages, I realize, but they're important for the contents of this book, to show the nature of this book. Key phrases in the book might be something like the ones you see on this list. According to the word of the Lord is used several different times. It's very important, a very important phrase in the book. This expression and its equivalent are found about 24 times in the book. So very significant would a phrase like that be. There's another phrase that occurs about 21 times, because they have done evil in my sight. You know, that really indicates to us who is the one that determines if a thought, a word, or an action of people is evil. Who determines that? Is that left up to man to determine? Not hardly, is it? God determines those things, doesn't He? Because they have done evil in my sight. Hence, so very important for us to try to learn to think like God, to feel like God feels about things, to have the view that God would have about things. How important that is. The man of God is a phrase that occurs about 36 times in the book, more than any other book of the Bible. Right in the sight of God occurs 8 times. The anger of the Lord is mentioned in this book. The wrath of the Lord is mentioned in this book. And it's not a very pleasant thing. Key chapter. If we were to pick out maybe a key chapter in the book, one that really stands out, it probably would have to be chapter 25, the last chapter. It records in that chapter the utter destruction of the city of God, the city of Jerusalem, and the temple. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had taken Jehoiachin to Babylon in the 8th year of his reign. In his stead, Nebuchadnezzar placed Zedekiah on the throne of Judah. And verse 24, chapter 24 and verse 13 and 14 say this: He carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord. You may remember the rich treasures that were characteristic of the reign of Solomon and his kingdom in his glory days. No kingdom on the earth has ever been as glorious as Solomon's kingdom was. No kingdom on the earth has probably ever been as enriched as Solomon's kingdom was. So if you think about all of these valuable treasures that became a part of this glorious temple that he built for the Lord, and then you see those treasures carried away here, it's a sad day for the history of the people of God. And he cut in pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, just as the Lord had said. Then he led away into exile all Jerusalem and all the captains and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives and all the craftsmen and the smiths. None remained except the poorest people of the land. The king of Babylon besieged the city of Jerusalem, we're told, until the 11th year of Zedekiah, in chapter 25 and verse 2. And the famine was so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land, verse 3 of this key chapter tells us. All the men of war and the king fled. The Chaldean army pursued the king and took him and brought him to Nebuchadnezzar, who passed sentence on him. In chapter 25, they slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. Could you imagine such a thing as that? A king watching his own sons being slaughtered, put to death before his eyes. What a gut-wrenching, heartbreaking scene that had to be. Then they put out the eyes of Zedekiah and bound him with bronze fetters and brought him to Babylon. You know, just a horrible thing. Nebuzaradan, captain of the guard, came to Jerusalem and he burned the house of the Lord, the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem, even every great house he burned with fire. So all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captains of the guard broke down the walls around Jerusalem. Then the rest of the people who were left in the city and the deserters who had deserted the king of Babylon and the rest of the people, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away into exile. But the captain of the guard left some of the poorest in the land to be vine dressers and plowmen. He took the priests to the king of Babylon, who struck them down and put them to death. What a horrible scene that must have been. The remnant of the people who remained in Jerusalem fled to Egypt. However, hope was still alive in those who were carried away to Babylon. God's messengers prophesied the return of a remnant of people to Jerusalem after 70 years of captivity. Their plight was improved in their 37th year in Babylon when evil Merodach, then king of Babylon, released Jehoiachin from prison and treated him kindly and honored him by setting his throne above the other kings in Babylon and gave him an allowance for each day, all the days of his life, at the end of chapter 25. So that's a pretty key chapter in the book, I think, don't you? A significant chapter in the book. The theme might be this tragic story of a continuation of the decline up to the destruction of both the divided kingdoms. This period may be described by the sad words corruption, disruption, decline, destruction, and desolation. Horrible words those are, aren't they? The appeal of the book, both 1 and 2 Kings, really is these are factual things that happened, learn from them. And what are we supposed to learn from such horrible events that happen like this? We're supposed to learn that faithful obedience to God is what God rewards. And if we fall away, and if we're not faithful to God, and if we don't treasure what He says and strive to do what He says, then trouble awaits us. It truly does. The chief aim of both books is to teach great moral lessons exemplified by the events in the history of the Jewish nation, in the lives of its leaders, and in the lives of its people. Every king is judged really not on the basis of how much economic prosperity the nation enjoys under his reign, but each king is judged as to his obedience or disobedience to the commands of Jehovah God. His success is measured by adherence to the law of God and by his God-honoring testimony before the heathen nations around them. The good of the nation depended upon its faithfulness to God. Idolatry, compromise of God's will, caused the decline and fall, both of Israel and Judah. Idolatry and all sin inevitably bring defeat and punishment. Faithfulness to God and righteous lives bring victory and joy. Events in the Jewish history are really lessons about righteousness and about justice and the loving kindness of God. All of these combined together, fit together to serve as a stern warning of the consequences of disobedience. Such a stern warning that is even voiced again in the pages of our New Testaments in 1 Corinthians 10. And verse 11, for example, now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. And in Romans 15, in verse 4, for whatsoever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope. There are some important things, very important things, to notice in this book. Elijah, it was taken up into heaven, and Elisha receives a double portion of his spirit at the beginning of this book. So when you start the book, you're interested to see what is that going to mean, and how is that going to affect the life of Elisha. Elisha rewards the hospitality of the Shunammite woman and her husband in chapter 4, a great passage of Scripture, an important thing to notice about the book. Also in this book, probably our young people would remember the name Naaman and the fact that he's called a leper, and his leprosy is healed in this very book. That's one primary thing that people usually remember about the book of 2 Kings. And particularly when they call to mind his expression in the book, "Behold, I thought." And what a great lesson that is, where one thinks the way it ought to be, but that's really not the way it is in God's mind. Also, Jezebel's gruesome death in this book is described for us in chapter 9. What a gruesome death that was. Because she was wicked. And God prophesied that she would die and the dogs would eat her remains. And that very thing happened as she was pushed out of a window. And her blood was spattered on the wall and on the horses of Jehu's chariot. Nothing left of her but her skull, her feet, and the palms of her hands. What a terrible fate for a wicked woman. Jehu's execution of divine justice upon Joram, Ahaziah, the guilty and obnoxious family of Ahab, and the worshipers of Baal in chapters 9 and 10. The evil reign and the idolatry of Ahaz, king of Judah, who walked in the ways of the kings of Israel and made his sons pass through the fire. You know, when I was younger and I read that, I thought, I was thinking about making someone's sons pass through fire. Does that mean that, like, we used to take a candle and set it up on the table as kids and kind of run our hands through the flames? Say, look, I can withstand fire. Is that what he meant by pass through fire? You know, for a long time as a young person, I thought that's probably what it meant. For some way they took their child and they moved it through fire for some reason. I didn't know what it was and didn't give much thought to it. That's not really what it means. It means that he made his sons pass away by means of executing them in fire as sacrifice to an idolatrous God. Could you imagine such a horrible thing as that? Putting to death your own children by burning them in fire to an idolatrous God. Now, I can't think of much more that would anger a righteous God than something like that. Can you? That's horrible. That's what happened in the history of God's people. In chapter 16, it's recorded in this book. Also, the fall of Israel, conquered by Assyria in chapter 17. Note that God used both the king of Assyria and the king of Babylon as his rod to punish the divided nations. We're told about Hezekiah's good reign in Judah in chapters 18 through 20. And the fact that he received higher praises than any other king of Judah. The great events of his reign were the deliverance of Judah from Assyria when God slew 185,000 Assyrians in one night. We read about his sickness and recovery and the religious reformation that he led. He destroyed the brazen serpent to which the Israelites had continued to offer incense since the time of Moses. Chapter 18, verse 4. This good king ruled between a wicked father, Ahaz, and a wicked son, Manasseh. But he was good. Manasseh's wickedness and the evil ways of his son, Amnon, are recorded in chapter 21. He was probably the worst of Judah's kings. Chapter 21 and verse 2 says that he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord dispossessed before the sons of Israel. He built altars and erected images of pagan gods. He caused the people to practice the vilest forms of idolatry, practiced wizardry, caused his son to pass through the fire, and shed much innocent blood. Because Manasseh so sinned and caused Judah to sin, God declared that he would bring such calamity on Jerusalem and Judah that whoever hears of it, both his ears will tingle, and I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish. What a horrible picture. Josiah's reforms. Following the discovery of the law in the temple in chapter 22 and 23, before him there was no king like him who turned to the Lord with all of his heart and with all his soul and with all his might according to all the law of Moses, nor did any like him arise after him. Chapter 23 and verse 25. Judah begins servitude in Babylon during the reign of Jehoiakim in chapter 24. Jehoiachin was taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar, you remember. And Nebuchadnezzar again enters Jerusalem and kills the sons of Zedekiah, puts out Zedekiah's eyes, binds him in fetters, and carries him to Babylon at the end of the book. The captain of the guard broke down the wall of Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, burnt the temple, the king's houses, and all the houses of Jerusalem. He despoiled the temple, took the valuable goods out of the temple, and made Gedaliah the governor, and took the poorest of the Jews captive, and his remnant murdered Gedaliah and fled to Egypt. After 37 years of captivity, Jehoiachin was graciously released at the end of the book. And another interesting thing, an important thing to notice about the book, is the fact that this book records 16 miracles by the prophet Elisha, some of which were that he increased the widow's oil. You young people may remember studying about that in your Bible classes. He raised the Shunammite's son in chapter 4. He healed Naaman the leper in chapter 5, caused an axe to float in chapter 6, and smote the Syrian army with blindness. Those are just some of the miracles that are recorded. Well, what can we learn from this book? You know, it's filled with great lessons, but just picking out a few things that might be important for us, what can we learn? One person can make a difference, I think, stands out in the book. Even one person who stands for God against all odds and against all other people, that one person can make a difference. And I'm thinking probably there about Elijah and Elisha, who stood for God against great opposition. When we feel overwhelmed by life, let us remember that there are things in the spiritual world which we do not see with these physical eyes. Prayer is to be an important part of the life of every follower of God, and there's a good reason for that. Spiritual things we don't see, spiritual resources available to us that we don't see, as Elisha had the Lord open the eyes of his servant to see the fiery chariots that would defeat the enemies. Ephesians 3 and verse 20 in the New Testament said, God is able to do far more abundantly beyond all that we ask or think according to the power that worketh within us. What a great passage that is. God has blessed us abundantly. What a tragedy it is to remain silent about those blessings, to not tell others about those, not share that good news. And that lesson is probably comes from chapter 7 and verse 9 in this book. You might remember that four lepers reported the flight of the Arameans, and they left, all of their goods. They were contemplating the fact that they would die of starvation. They were outside the city. They couldn't go in. They were four lepers. And so we're going to take our chances. We're going to go out there to the enemy. If they kill us, we're going to die anyway. So they go out there and see that the enemy has fled and left all of their foodstuffs and all of their clothing and all of their belongings. They struck it rich. And they contemplated, should we go back to town and tell what happened here? And they decided to do that very thing. Good news is something to be shared, isn't it? There's a message in 2 Kings for every nation on earth, I think. An important lesson. Here we see the powerful influence that leaders of a nation have, not only on their nation, but also on the other nations of the world. When a nation goes away from God, they're headed for destruction. They may not see it coming at the time. They may not want to see it coming at the time. But when any nation on this earth leaves God behind, only destruction, only trouble is in the future. We may think about that in connection with our own nation. Sometimes it's delayed, but still, it's inevitable. God is in control. Men may think they're in control. Men may think all the final decisions rest upon me, but that's not true. God is always in control, and He will not be mocked. Galatians 6 and verse 7. God's anger is kindled against His people when they become unfaithful. The best course of action would be faithful, right? What a powerful lesson in this book. Satan tried to continually frustrate God's plan to bring the Messiah into the world. Wicked Athaliah attempted to destroy the line of David, but God's plans cannot be thwarted. And there are other lessons in the book that are equally valuable, but time won't allow us to go into those. But hopefully, we've mentioned something to spark something in your remembrance, to make you appreciate God and His relationship with His people. Make you appreciate something you've studied and learned in the past that will help you as you go out from here and try to live as a Christian this week. That's our prayer and that's our hope. We can help you in your to walk closer to God when you leave this building than when you first came in. We'd be delighted to do that. And if we can, please come and let us know while we stand together and encourage you by singing the invitation song.